Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're going to Paris to visit Google Arts and Culture. This is a branch of the tech company that deals with the fun stuff, the stuff that you might hang on a wall, the stuff you might do at weekends or might go on a date to, or might feel you don't know enough about and are therefore keen to jump into feet first. This part of Google was set up to apply technology to culture, sometimes to provide digital solutions to hoary old problems, sometimes, and why not, just for fun. On the day I visited, Google Arts and Culture was showcasing a handful of their new experiments. Often these are things that show off some fairly dandy new tech with the aid of some beautiful art. And in a stunning hôtel particulier near the Gare Saint-Lazare sits a brave new world of screens, primary coloured walls in Google colours, and bright-eyed brains in hoodies. Come on, let's meet the dudes. The man that dreamt up Google Arts and Culture is now its director and is called Amit Sood. After using museums as a source of good coffee and nice vibes, but less so as a resource for stunning art, Sood felt that technology could help museums display their collections in bold new ways. Sood is a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, Bombay-born, well-travelled livewire who seems like a benign junior Gandalf in a sharp navy suit, conjuring marvels out of thin air with an android-aided wizard staff.
I was working in London back in 2010, and I had the chance to visit some of the most amazing museums because I was in London. And I basically pitched a project, a 20% project, which I told my boss that I'll do on the weekends with some support, which was to...
We've all done that before.
Exactly. It is never 20%, but if you have friendly bosses, it always helps. And so I think the idea then was, hey, let's just do a simple project where we try and bring a few museums to come together rather than on their separate websites, to show a few of their artworks, but in a very different, special way, with high resolution zooming into the artworks so that it's not a transactional experience. There's some emotion to it. And you can obviously see details that you couldn't see physically. That's all I wanted to do. And then I thought I'll move on. So we launched 17 museums in 2011, the Tate being one of our founding partners, MoMA, Met, a few of them. And essentially, the project surpassed our expectations based on the reactions from users. And suddenly we realized that actually people are craving access to culture. And that's why I started this, because I wanted to show my friends in India some of the cool works at the Tate or the cool works at the MoMA. And I realized that, hey, it's not just my friends, it's people who even think that art is not for them. So it became my 100% in around 2012. Luckily, we got support to create in Paris and London. So we are half based in London, half based in Paris, this cultural institute. And it's a non-profit, non-commercial organization within the company with a small group of engineers. And we get to work 100% with museums, archives, and foundations. And it's we love it. And the idea was to bring all these stories, all these objects in a new and interesting way online. And so what we've created is this platform. It's called Google Arts and Culture. Every morning, I spend 15 minutes before I start my day completely being surprised by something on the platform. Because you have butterfly collection from the Natural History Museum. Then you have stories about Jeju women in Korea who are diving for pearls and diving for food. Then you have stories about the Taj Mahal. So you really have like this completely crazy broad tent of world culture. And that's what it is.
I mean, the genesis of the whole thing was a curiosity about making museums more accessible than they are, and some of your own personal kind of curiosity about some of these artworks and where and how they were stored and lit and produced for the general public, I suppose. But nowadays, now that this thing exists and has a life of its own, now it's 100% very definitely, if not 500 by the sound of it. Does the technology lead the way that you want to present the art? And it's a very broad cultural remit. I mean, we're talking about painting specifically. Just now, or is it still the curiosity about some of those cultural things that leads to technology?
I think it's a very good question, and I think it's one I struggle with, to be very honest with you, because I ask myself the question, and not just me, our product managers, we ask, is the technology in the background or is the art in the background? You know, we don't always get it 100% right, because we are kind of, let's say, experimenting, but I think when I get confused and I don't have an answer to that question, I test my thinking. So there are two options. Either a person who's already exposed to art and loves it and is very cultural, have they gone deeper? If that tick mark happens, then I don't care if the technology is at the forefront because they got deeper into the art. The second test I use, litmus test I use, is that if a person who does not care about art found a way for even 1 minute in their day to look at something that they would have never looked at, litmus test done.
Yeah.
But not at any cost, right? There has to be some balances in terms of the way the artwork is presented, in terms of the respect to the curation, respect to the story behind it. That's one of the things I learned the hard way, because I was just going around zooming, and I was not really understanding the story. And, you know, at some point after I zoomed 100 times into the Starry Night, I was like, okay, you know, I need to know now what the hell is, why is this so interesting? And then the curators explained to me, and then we said, okay, we need to build a curator tool. So that's why we built this whole curation thing. And so I think context is king.
And just finally, Amit, we've talked a lot about paintings, Van Gogh, and all these great works from Tate and MoMA and all the rest of it. Do you think, nicely, there is a bit of a fetishizing of these wonderful, famous images? I mean, it's a great way to display some of the amazing technology that goes on here. But also, I wonder in the future, do you think that people might go, okay, so they were celebrating these great works of art, but they didn't realize that the technology was something artistic in itself, that there is a great sort of, that maybe we're kind of hiding our light under a bushel, we're being a little bit shy about some of the amazing application of some of this technology, rather than always talking simply about the way that we can understand a painting better with it.
100%. In fact, a painting in the early days, I would say when paint was invented, that was a technology, right? It's just that I think now we have become more siloed in the way we like to bucket people. Mm. So an engineer is an engineer, and an artist is an artist. And you know, this. And one of the things I learned with this project is that working a lot with engineers is a lot of them are artists in their own right. And that is the main reason why we started doing these lab collaborations. Because so far what we've been talking about is the general product, which is the Google Arts and Culture thing. But the more interesting exploratory part of what I do and what the team does is the lab. Because over there, what you're doing is you're taking an engineer, you're putting him with what a traditional artist might be, then you're connecting him with an institution, him or her with an institution, and then you're seeing magic happen. So who is really the artist, right? And I think it's collaboration that is key. You're very right. The technology also should be celebrated. But I think the works of art, celebrating them, I think I have kind of moved on from that part. I still think it's great and we should keep doing it. And I'm really, really hell-bent on intangible culture, because I feel like there is no museum where you can go and have a physical picture of a story being told by a community, right? And I think over there, the technology will automatically become the hero as well, because it will enable these intangible culture stories to come out more fast.
So to the experiments. One such was the prototype of an app that allows you to take a selfie on your phone and then matches it with a portrait from a huge archive of digitized images of the world's great art. I did it and got a portrait of a gentleman in the Dutch school style, a bourgeois man about town in a fine silk ruff and a buckled hat under the arm. A handsome chap, for sure. What can I say? The second time, I was less toothsome, but at least painted by Rembrandt. It's very good and very shareable, and here are the people that made it.
I am Michelle. I work with our team of engineers and designers to build new features into the Google Arts and Culture app.
And congratulations on your latest and, I won't say greatest, but very famous piece of work, which is this amazing selfie machine. What's it called?
It's our selfie experiment. It's a way for you to take a selfie and find artworks using your selfie.
And I've come into what is something of an inner sanctum here at Google France. We're upstairs in something that looks disarmingly like a shed. In quite a charming way. I wasn't expecting this. I was expecting it to look like a laboratory. Is this one of the places where stuff like this is made, is tested, is experimented?
Yes, exactly. This is our workshop. This is where our artists in residence and creative coders work. This is the space where Google Cardboard was created. And it's also the space where Cyril first worked on the experiment that later became the feature that we launched.
Okay, well, I think we're going to test it out. I'm going to try to make as handsome a face as I possibly can, so I don't necessarily end up as a Bruegel. Let's test it out. Hi, Cyril.
I'm Cyril Diagne. I'm a digital interaction artist in residency here at the Google Arts and Culture Lab.
Can we have a go at the selfie machine, the selfie experiment?
Sure. Okay, here you go.
Okay, so we've got a different... So we did do it before, didn't we? We've got a slightly different... We've got portrait of a man. I've been downgraded from a gentleman to a man. But I'm still Dutch by the look of it. The second... My second choice is portrait of a gentleman with a tall hat by Rembrandt. I think I'll take that one. So where did the impetus come to start this project in particular?
One of the ideas with Art Selfie was how to provide people an entry point to this breadth of content that we all are in awe with. And we thought through a very simple feature that everyone does every day with their phones, which is to take a selfie, how can we apply machine learning to help this simple gesture connect them with a breadth of 6 million artworks?
It's a funny thing, isn't it? Because it's just the crack of a smile or you know, squinting one eye more than the other, or perhaps the light that you're standing in as well can suddenly put you in a Javanese portrait or a Dutch portrait, or put you turn you into a piece of sort of Japanese porcelain or something like that. The possibilities are kind of endless. How sensitive is the device, do you think?
The algorithm is trying to look for portrait subjects that look like you. It will give you the same things often, and then sometimes when you change your facial expression or the lighting or something, you may get a different result. But for the most part, we're trying to find something that looks like you so that you can feel that personal connection with the artwork.
And what's a mark of the success of something like this? I know it's called an experiment. I'm sure it's got lots of sort of very practical uses in the future for all sorts of things. But what marks a success? Is it simply people's curiosity? Where does success come from in a venture like this?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. But one aspect that I particularly like is how people want to communicate about those matches and how they very often dig into the artwork and the story of the artwork. Who created it? When? What is it about? What's happening in it? And it offers them a gateway to talk about it and an entry point to communicate about art. And it's something that's very pleasurable. So naturally, people do it.
And it's kind of addictive, strangely. Or you certainly want to share the results with as many people as possible, I suppose. And I suppose that's how it spreads.
I think so, yeah. Like I said earlier, I think people do feel a personal connection with the artworks. There's that serendipity of you take a selfie, you don't really know what you're going to get. But you do know that it's going to be a very nice artwork from a renowned institution that's on the Google Arts and Culture platform. So you can then share your results, but also find out more about the stories behind them.
Another enriching application for all this technology is Google's partnership with the Archive of Life magazine, the wonderful journal that really documented much of the 20th century with historically important photography of world-changing events. I spoke to the archivist and artist responsible for this thing that, by the way that they've skewed the notion of a search engine, allows strange and sometimes poignant and poetic associations between seemingly disparate things and makes us question the criteria of classification itself.
My name is Gael, and I'm working as art in residency at the Google Lab here. And I'm invited usually to get into planting new experiments with the Cultural Institute contents and the global Google technology.
And I'm Jill Golden. I'm the director of the Life magazine photo archives, and we've had a partnership with Google since 2006. And Gael, an artist in residence, approached us, I guess, last year to work on a Life Tags project.
And we're looking at a screen, and this was part of the presentation earlier. You showed us on this huge wall of screens that wraps itself around the Google Lab here, some of the different possibilities of using something as rich and deep as the Life magazine photo archive and article archive, I guess, as well. And it's an amazing thing. So I suppose there's two things coming together here, where there is a powerful machine and there is a deep archive. There is something very manual and old-fashioned and old media meeting something that is sort of being bent into a new shape by something very new media. Jill, what have you sort of learnt from this archive by approaching it in a different way or by having a machine kind of lead you around the ballroom?
Yeah, so it's surfacing different stories and images and artists that we might have overlooked before by navigating the archive by story or by celebrity, figured, or subject. So I think in a way it's a fun toy that helps us kind of surface overlooked content.
Yeah, and I suppose by putting something that you might even not have thought was covered by Life despite the depth of that archive and the sort of multifarious interest of that magazine, you can put what you think is a daringly pointless word in.
Yes,
or something, an impossible task, basically. Yeah. And you'll get sort of something quite rich back.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because the Gael can speak more to how he developed it, but the vocabulary is very specific. So this morning I found myself falling down the rabbit hole of active pants through history. So the algorithm tags, you know, athletic or leisure pants, and so it's a fun way to look at how people exercise from the 40s, you know, through the 2000s. So it's really delightful and fun to play with.
And Gael, this is amazing. So this is, we're stretching the muscles of this toy a little bit, aren't we? What's, for example, this Life project shown you about how and why this machine thinks in the way it does?
So actually, the interesting thing is just to realize that it's a machine, it's algorithm that's related a lot with our way to perceive things, to perceive images, and also sometimes that shows the differences, because as it's not perfect, it makes sometimes mistakes that we can understand and analyze as human, but that we can understand why an algorithm can be wrong too. And that's, to me, the most interesting thing in the technical part, because also in the artistic part, because you'll be surprised sometimes how a machine can define subjective notions or even complex concepts, and you can then just agree or not with its decision. So it's always a surprise, and this kind of being surprised while you're creating some kind of project like this, it's a really satisfying thing.
The image in front of us is an actress, presumably at the premiere of a movie, in a red dress, in a red velvet dress. So if we search Oscars, or we search red carpet or red dress, we get images like this. But I know that something that you was part of your presentation earlier was typing in Darth Vader into this machine, and getting lots of images from the front cover of Time, and maybe the front cover of Life itself, and all of those things, maybe film stills inevitably. But then getting some odd things that were suggestive of the face of this famous movie character, but weren't him. And as you said, that makes you think about subjective learning. Is it that, or is it the computer kind of looking at images through a cloudy day? What do we put that down to?
Actually, it's really basic. A machine just get the data, analyze them, and put them together, trying to link the dots. And actually, when we see these pictures, who are obviously not the face of Darth Vader, we can, as I've said before, understand why it can be mistaken, because of all the common features in the image that are quite basic, like it's maybe just lines or difference of shadows and lights that just shows, like, if it could have been seen by a human, won't that be wrong?
And we worked with Gael, you know, because of these kind of cloudy day problems. So each image actually links back to more information about the photo and to us, in case people have any questions, you know, about the archive and the story behind the image. So it kind of starts out as a fun toy and a way to initially enter the archive, but it can go as deep, you know, as the researcher, as the user wants. So,
as an archivist, you obviously have such a broad and deep knowledge of the subject of Life magazine, but this presumably pulls you into directions and into parts of the archive, the sort of some of the, for you at least, dusty corners that you wouldn't have explored before. How have you done that? How have you kind of flexed the muscles of this machine?
Yeah, so it definitely provides a quirkier 21st century look at the archive. For me, you know, the collection is this incredible piece of cultural heritage that explains the 20th century through a variety of facets. And in some ways, this kind of brings an interesting modern look at kind of what the archive can offer. So I think the charm and delight and wonder of this, basically a toy, can really kind of raise historical questions that we might not have posed otherwise.
Do you see in a project specifically like this the difference of what you might call, you know, the old-fashioned notion of an archive that is decades and decades of a particularly august magazine, and the way that information was organized and edited within the pages of that magazine, and a new way in which people are searching for things, and in fact that media is made, that articles, content, is made. Do you find a difference between the two, looking at comparing and contrasting this?
Yeah, so I mean, our archive, the physical archive and the way that we work with it is organized contextually, so it's story-based. So that example during the presentation of Lisa Larson's photographs of JFK's wedding. And what this does is it decontextualizes the image, which has, you know, interesting opportunities and interesting problems. And the fact that we're in dialogue with Gael and with Google about this process is really important to us because it poses a lot of questions that we would like to explore together as archivists with technologists and artists too.
Does it, and I wonder, Gael, as well, whether this for you and whether some of the conversations at Google as well have been, when you've got an archive of this sort, which has a sort of journalistic rigor to it, whether actually that's something that a technology company can perhaps learn from as well, kind of go, look at how they've done this. They've done it unthinkingly, but rather beautifully and elegantly. And whether that's something that can be transposed to some of the other work that's done in such a big company like this.
Yeah, it's really inspiring when you have this kind of content, and then just as a person, you have that creates your own story in your mind. And for example, this experiment to me popped up like I really wanted to join these keywords and the pictures like I used when I was in school, and we had this dictionary that was combining words and pictures. It was more fun to learn how to write them down or stuff like that because they were pictures. And this was this specific illustrated dictionary at my time. And this is exactly what I wanted to create, is having this funny access to labels and pictures together, and hopefully that it creates something new and something that in my mind popped like a memory of something that I loved when I was a kid. So actually, I hope it's efficient. So that's another story. So that's the user to try. But I think you can get lost for a long time jumping from one image to a keyword to another image, and that's the goal of it.
Laurent Gaveau is the head of the Google Arts and Culture Lab. The lab is the bit where these applications, often quite madcap inventions, are dreamed up and tested until they go wrong, and then tested until they go right. It's in his rather charming, shed-like part of the building that these things are developed.
So the way we work is inviting some of our partners to think with us, what is the right use case, what should we do? Should we do something first? Maybe not.
if it's Friday lunchtime, maybe not.
Exactly. Yeah, most of the time it's really a conversation. And here at the lab especially, we are all about research and development, partnering with the ecosystem, artists in residency, creative coders, curators, historians, researchers. It all starts with a conversation and a pretty open brainstorm. Then if we feel we have a good idea, we start a pilot project, which means building a prototype. Mm-hmm. And then if we think the prototype is working and is answering an important question, we go to the experiment stage, which is what we are launching today, a set of new experiments. And then from there, it can go bigger
anywhere
and scale.
Yeah. So do people come to you with problems, the artists, historians, archivists? Or do you go, hang on, we've got this new tool and it does this. Who could we get to test it? I know, it would be someone that works for a magazine, someone that works with an archive, for example. Which way does the river flow?
So, for example, if we look at the MoMA archives problem, they came to us with a challenge, which was to match the pictures of all the MoMA exhibitions during the 20th century, starting in 2029, with their current database. Basically, they had this incredible set of images from all those iconic images, but they are black and white, and you don't know what is depicted in those images. So here, the challenge came from them, from also an open call to them saying, do you have any issue that you would like us to help with? And we applied some machine learning algorithm to match those images with the actual digital version of the artwork in their database, which make it, starting today, much more interesting and user-friendly to browse this amazing data set of images. For the Life Tag project, it's a little bit different. We are partnering with Life for 10 years now, I think, and they are using Google Arts and Culture, the platform and the app, to present about 4 million of their beautiful images, most of their collection of photojournalism for the 20th century. Here it's an artist here at the lab who was exploring ideas with us, And we said, okay, I have an idea with these 4 million images that are a little bit overwhelming and difficult to browse and difficult to understand. And it was, again, using machine learning and some other open data sources online to create this encyclopedic version of the 4 million images. So here we invited actually Life to come and discuss with us the prototype we had imagined, and they were super happy. So it's now available for everybody to discover.
And that's a very elegant, easy way of seeing how the kind of deep learning that technology can offer to something that is an archive and is very deep, but it's kind of static. You know, it exists and it's all bits of paper in a filing system somewhere. And this presents, I was fascinated by the Life one particularly because it gives you such a three or even sort of four dimensional, if that's possible, way of understanding something that already exists. There's something nice about that, that a lot of technology is used to whiz off into the future, but this is actually something that nourishes the past and brings that back to life. Do you care about doing that and about Google being able to do that? Or is it just a happy accident, I wonder?
It might be a happy accident. No, I do care about... So at the heart of our project, of course, it's users and how they engage with arts and culture. And especially because our team is both very technologically advanced, but it's also artists and people who have some views on design. In the specific case of the Life Tag experience, for example, Gael Hugo, who is the artist who worked on it, from the start wanted this interesting look and feel, which is a little bit, I wouldn't say old-fashioned, but a specific look and feel. Mm. I can only invite people to go and have a look. And what's important for us, for sure, is that the technology should be invisible. It's always the case. We started, for example, with an art camera, which is a way to scale super high-resolution capture of some masterworks around the world. It's a pretty strong piece of technology. But everything should be behind the user experience. And I'm happy with what you mentioned about Life Tags because it's really what we want. It's not a showcase for the technology. It's a stage for the content, and it's powered by technology.
And it shows a certain amount of humility to sort of say the technology should be invisible. When you're in charge of this stuff, it's a technology company. And I know we're in a cultural part of it, in a culture lab part of it. I wanted to ask you quickly, Laurent, about AI and about machine learning. And we've seen that elegantly displayed in some of your presentations this morning in the lab. Some people feel that that is a brave new world of wonder, and some people think it's a little bit scary. What's your kind of understanding of machine learning? Maybe you can give us an example, in fact, from stuff that we've seen today, of how that's being used in a very, what you might call human way, or a very kind of, in a kind of charming way.
So you're right. I think machine learning is a, for me and for the mission we have, which is to make culture accessible to anyone, anywhere, machine learning is one of the many tools and one of the many emerging technologies we can use. We've been working a lot around virtual reality, a lot around augmented reality, on some physical installations. And machine learning and the access we have at Google to some very interesting algorithm and concept is another way that we want to explore to fulfill this mission. And in the case, for example, of the selfie experiment that we launched in the US a few weeks ago, and that has been a big success, matching your selfie with a portrait somewhere in the collections of museums around the world, and that looks like you most of the time.
What were you? I was a Dutch gentleman, and then I did it again and I was just a Dutchman. I really loved it. Now I like it slightly less.
I've been lucky. I am a sketch by Edvard Munch.
Oh, very nice.
So I think I was very happy. My self-esteem was high because it's a very important artwork. Then the person depicted is quite scary. So, well, you can't have it all.
You win some, you lose some, Laurent. That's culture and that's tech, I suppose.
Exactly. You have to live with that.
So that was a short, sharp trip to Google's playful and artistic side. It's a company that can't help but change culture, such as its size, reach, and ubiquity, but here at least is also holding hands with some of the things, the museum, the printed magazine archive, that it has been said to challenge.
There's a sort of sense of mission about Google Arts and Culture, but not an overwhelming sense of bowing to the gods of tech, more perhaps like new light through old windows. We'll come back here one day when all this stuff is standard on your phone or the received way of sending a birthday card or being able to look at almost all of the art in the world at the squeak of an Alexa and be glad to have seen it first and been likened to a handsome Dutch merchant from 1599. That brings us to the end of Culture. The show was produced by Holly Fisher and I've been Robert Bound. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, thanks for tuning in.